welcome to Connectivity 225. I'm your host, Nicholas Bray, and today I'm joined by Brian Rose.
What's up?
And Curtis Bonds.
Hi.
Yes, and today we're going to be talking a little bit about Banjo-Kazooie and a bit about the collectathon sort of subgenre in general. So, yeah, you guys, I know Kurtz is sort of a big fan of the Banjo games. Brian, what's your sort of take on the Banjo games?
I've played the first one and I really enjoyed it, and I've tried playing the second one. I have both on the Xbox, and I've been playing the second one, or at least I've been trying to, but things just happen and I haven't really had a chance to just sit down and play through it all. But I have played through the first one, and I really enjoyed that one. And also, I mean, we're not going to talk about it because it's a Xbox one, but I played the third game and it sucks, so.
We don't speak of the third game in this house.
Yeah, we don't speak about that game.
So before we jump into sort of our main thoughts on the game, I thought we'd just have a peruse across sort of a bit of the history and the early development of it. So as most people know, the Banjo game started out as a game called Project Dream for the Super Nintendo. It was being made by like the Donkey Kong Country team, I think. And they started sort of messing around with late Super Nintendo pre-rendered stuff, I think, for this Project Dream game, which was, I think it was going to be some sort of like weird, like adventure game, like pirate.
I think they went through several concepts. I've seen a video of this recently. It was very recently that they showed footage of this for the first time, Project Dream. It was supposed to be a Super Nintendo game, and
yeah,
it was supposed to be more of an RPG game than a platformer. And I think they said that they were going to borrow heavily from JRPGs and stuff like that, but
it seems like it's sort of coming back in a weird way with Rare's current game, yeah, Sea of Thieves.
That's true.
Because it was going to be a pirate sort of thing. And yeah. So the development sort of fell apart on that, and they ended up refocusing on a game that was modeled after Mario 64, which is obviously Banjo-Kazooie. Banjo, the character, actually came from, like, he was going to be a side character in Dream, and they ended up sort of taking that character and adapting it to Banjo-Kazooie, obviously probably heavily redesigning whatever the original bear was going to be. And then, yeah, they ended up going along and adding in Kazooie, and I think it started out with the backpack on Banjo was just like going to have wings that sprouted out so he could fly, but then ended up turning it into a character. Banjo-Kazooie came out in, what, 1998?
Mm-hmm.
I think it started development in 97. Yeah, okay. It started development in March 1997 with a team of about 10 people. And the team grew to about 15 by the end of the game. So 15 people made Banjo-Kazooie.
That's amazing, considering today's game development scenario.
I know, it's crazy. It's like the same amount of people that made Mario 64 as well. And like today there's teams of like hundreds of people.
Yes.
And they managed to make that entire game in less than 2 years, which is kind of, again, amazing if you think about it. You have these teams of just like dozens, if not hundreds of people, and sometimes they don't even see the light of day for another like 3 years.
Yeah, like, especially like, because later on, Rare sort of became infamous for like taking ages to put games out on the 360 and the Xbox. Like, they just sort of.
Yeah, but they managed to just spit one out. I mean, I don't want to say it in like a derogatory or like, you know, negative sense, because you know they made some quality ass games.
They were on fire during like 1995 to 2001. They just pumped out so many games for the 64.
Mm-hmm.
Another little tidbit of information is that the characters, the graphics to render the Banjo-Kazooie. They used minimal amounts of like texturing on the main characters, but ended up going with like the largest size textures possible on the 64 for like the rest of the game. So it's like 64 by 64 texture size, I guess, like the resolution of the texture. So, and like, even today, when you play on the Xbox 360, the textures and stuff look pretty nice, considering.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised just how nice that game looked. Considering it was such an old game in retrospect. But like, you know, I never really played it that much on the N64. Like, I saw it a lot, my friends played it a lot, but I didn't actually get like deep into it until I bought the 360 version. And yeah, I was kind of blown away how much the game just kind of held up, like, visually. I mean, the gameplay, of course, but like, visually, it was still kind of stunning.
It holds up way, way better than Mario 64, which really doesn't graphically hold up.
Yeah.
It's the first of its kind, so I mean, I kind of give it some slack for that. But at the same time, it's just, you look at something like Mario 64 compared to Banjo Kazooie, and it's like, oh yeah, I can see where.
This is the result of 2 years of development compared to Mario 64, which it was launch title. Mm-hmm. You see how much Nintendo 64 could go with a game like Banjo-Kazooie.
Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, even then you compare Banjo-Kazooie to Banjo-Tooie, and the graphic leap is even like, it's pretty great again. I was watching Beta 64 last night. I think Beta 64. Anyway, I was watching something about Banjo-Kazooie, and stuff with like the water in Banjo-Kazooie, it's just like a flat texture with like animated ripples and stuff on the top of it. But on Banjo-Tooie, the water was all like three-dimensional, and like the waves and stuff could like ripple and move and stuff like. So that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Banjo-Tooie, that came out in 2000, right?
Yeah, 2000. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just like, let's see. So yeah, that was just like barely a 2 year difference between Banjo-Kazooie and, you know, Banjo-Tooie, and seeing that big of a leap, not only graphically but just the world in general. Like, I was like, even playing it like back to back with Banjo-Kazooie on the 360, I was still just kind of taken aback at just how much they managed to, you know, just increase like every single aspect of that game.
Mm.
Like, and considering both were on the same platform, within the span of 2 years, you can do so much more with that same engine. It's just really goes to show how talented those people at Rare really were.
And when you like think about it, it's like weird to think that 1998 you had Banjo-Kazooie, 1999 you had DK64, and then 2000 you had Banjo-Tooie.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, DK64, that was 99, yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of forget like the timeline of those games, because
I mean, it was technically a different team that worked on DK64, yeah, but there was a bit of crossover with some of the staff members.
Mm-hmm.
DK64 adapted a cut level from Banjo-Kazooie. Fungi Forest was going to be in Banjo originally, but that was
cut. Yeah, you know what? That level does actually feel... I always felt like the Fungi Forest level in DK64 felt a little... I don't want to say out of place, because it's a great level.
Yeah.
But like, it always seemed like that much more special.
Mm.
Like, compared to the other worlds in DK64. And as you guys know, if you listen to, Radio Free Nintendo, last episode that I was on there, I kind of shared my, ashamed reverence for Donkey Kong 64. Like, I know it's a garbage game, but I absolutely love every single aspect of it. I mean, garbage in the sense of how games should be designed. Like, I know there's a lot of issues with that game, but god damn it, I love it so much.
You know, I played it for the first time a year and a half ago, and, you know, I didn't expect to try and get everything, but I ended up getting everything.
Yeah, I 100%ed that game, like, multiple times as a kid.
And I actually enjoyed it, like...
Yeah.
We're not talking about DK at the moment, but yeah, I sort of did enjoy playing that at the time, and I didn't think I would get into it as much as I did. But anyway, let's go back to Banjo-Kazooie. So we'll start just sort of talking a bit about like our time back in the day with the game and some of our thoughts. So, Kurt, do you want to go ahead and start that off?
Yeah, sure. So, like I was saying earlier, I never really played much of Banjo-Kazooie as a kid. And I was 12 at the time. And our family wasn't really poor, per se, but we were definitely limited on how many games like I was able to play during the year, whether it be through Blockbuster rentals or, you know, outright actually buying games. So stuff like Banjo-Kazooie just kind of took a backseat to things I knew I would enjoy, and some things I thought I would enjoy, like the Rugrats PS1 game or Paperboy 64. And, yeah, those weren't great, but I kind of wish I could tell myself, hey, try Banjo-Kazooie, you will absolutely love it. And considering how much, again, I love Donkey Kong 64, I'm just surprised that I never really gave Banjo-Kazooie or Banjo-Tooie any further thought than just, like, watching my friends play or talk about them.
Yeah.
And, yeah, years later, they both came out on Xbox 360 HD remasters and, you know, some much-needed improvements, not only with the camera, but how you progress and getting the notes and stuff.
Oh, man, yeah, the like notes that in Banjo-Kazooie being deleted every time you die or leave the level, just evil.
Yeah. I can't even imagine how frustrating that would have been if I actually played it back then. But I'm still glad I ended up giving it a shot because I absolutely fell in love with Banjo-Kazooie, like, right away. Like, I was, like, from the moment I started it to the moment I finished it, when I struck the final blow, well, I didn't strike the final blow to Grunty, but finally getting to the end and beating Grunty was just, like, a phenomenal experience. There's so much soul and character and care just put into the entire experience. I was just absolutely in love with everything about that game. The one thing I didn't really love was like, I kind of did get lost a little bit inside like Grunty's cave.
Yeah, I still do like in the later like sections of the lair. I still got sort of get confused and forget what door leads to where.
Yeah. So I never really memorized like which pot led to which place in the cave. So I just kind of ran everywhere or walked everywhere.
Yeah,
and hopefully I found where exactly I needed to go, but. Yeah, just even replaying the game like a year ago, I started realizing just what I loved about that game, what I loved about, you know, that kind of genre of 3D platformer, is that everything had, every single thing, every single item, every single person you talk to had their own story. Even if it's just a few sentences long, they have some sort of motive for what they're doing, what they're protecting, and just their own personality. Even something as small as a Christmas light or some polar bear that ate too much and isn't going home to his kids because he's a lazy sack of crap. I just love discovering every single little thing in what ended up actually being kind of compact worlds, at least in Banjo-Kazooie. Like, I was kind of surprised how much character and thought they put into what is generally kind of a small area. Like, yeah. In each area, like Mumbo's Mountain and Freezeezy Peak and the desert area, was like, realistically speaking, they're all like kind of small, but they feel so much bigger because there's so many things to talk to, so many things to discover and find and manipulate and it all controls really well. I mean, there's some things here and there that were like maybe narrow platforms or something that were like a little on the iffy side. Like, you know, not everything about the game is perfect, but you know, for something as ambitious as that game, I'll kind of let it slide, especially in the 360 version where things are definitely improved with the camera.
I'm not sure. And, I'm not sure they did improve the camera work in the game though. Like, I didn't remember them talking about that because like,
if I remember right, the camera in the 360 version of the game, you had like kind of free reign over it because it was a stick rather than buttons.
Maybe they gave it full analog control. Or
something. Full analog control on the camera. Yeah, which that's what I liked about it. And it was even it, and all the writing. Like I said, the writing is, it's childish, but at the same time, it's incredibly endearing. Like all the characters are really funny.
It's like like the jokes and stuff are like dad jokes in a way. They're like worthy, but like funny at the same time. Yeah,
they're corny, but the way that the game is,
I love the back and forth between like Bottles and Kazooie.
Oh man, that was a high pot. I always loved finding Bottles and seeing just how much of an asshole Kazooie was to him for no real reason.
I don't know if it was exactly in this game, might be in later games, but I kind of just like how it's self-aware at times, and I just kind of like that. I think it's funny because, you know, Mario games don't kind of have that, like, I don't know if it's, you want to call it fourth wall humor. I think that might be in later titles, but what I like about this series in general is that it's kind of a bit more, fun. The writing is. It's a bit more fun.
It doesn't take itself
too seriously.
Yeah, it knows it's a video game. It knows some of the premises are a bit silly. And at the same time, it just takes it seriously enough where it's, you don't really think about how silly some of the things are.
Yeah. Exactly.
And let's see, anything else I wanted to talk about Banjo-Kazooie? How could I forget the music? You know, Grant Kirkhope's absolutely brilliant soundtrack in that game. Just, like, I still hum some of those songs every single day.
Jolly Roger Bay?
Oh, yeah, Jolly Roger Bay.
That's in
really
2, yeah.
That's a really...
Oh, is that in 2E?
Yeah.
I think that's
in 2E. The one you're thinking of is probably Treasure Trove Cove.
Oh, Treasure Trove Cove. Of course. Yeah. And, Freeze AC Peak, I also really like. I mean, I'm always a sucker for Christmas-themed, like, anything.
I love Rare's winter levels. They always knock it out of the park with, like, the colouring and the music. Mm-hmm. And, like, even in, like, Yooka-Laylee has brought that back. Like, the colour of the snow and the world in that game. Is just like the 64, how they used to do that.
That's where I'm. I'm making my way through the snow level in Yooka-Laylee, so I'm. That music is definitely helping that stage out a lot. I mean, the stage is already really cool, but the music definitely is in line with Rare's best.
And like in Banjo, they had a lot of the dynamic music, which was sort of like a thing on the 64. Like, Nintendo did it a lot with, like, Ocarina of Time and stuff like that. But, like, yeah, Banjo, they do it a lot. Like, even when you go underwater, it becomes all... The level of music becomes all muffled and...
Yeah.
It sounds like you're underwater.
That's a nice touch.
Yeah.
I remember specifically in Treasure Trove Cove when you are fighting that one, the hermit crab, and you have to go inside the hermit crab's shell, and it is more of, like, kind of a soft calypso... it's already a calypso theme, but it's... A little more echoey, a little more ambient, but it still like kind of continues on from, you know, when you entered it.
And I really going up high in the game too, because it usually drops the music and it's just sound effects when you're up really high. I think it does that in other levels besides Treasure Trove Cove. I think it might do it on Freeze Easy as well.
Yeah, I think it's just more memorable in Treasure Trove Cove because it's the first point in the game where you can kind of see the entire level in that regard, where you can get just so high and just like take in everything. It's like, wow, this is next gen. I can see the beach. Wow.
So, Brian, when did you first play Kazooie?
I remember getting it as a birthday present in, like, I think the year it came out, or maybe 1999, I forget which. But I didn't really play it for some reason. I guess I just didn't get into it. It wasn't until the Xbox 360 version came out, and that's where I really played it. And I think I got to the final boss, and I didn't beat the final boss. I think there's, like, towards the end, there's, like, a quiz kind of thing. I beat that, but I didn't beat the very last part with the Gruntilda.
Yeah.
The big battle with Gruntilda. I don't know why, but...
It's kind of hard and kind of annoying.
It is hard. It is hard compared to the rest of the game. Gruntilda's fight is
really, really hard. I remember, like... I think I was streaming. I was streaming the finale of that game. I was streaming my entire first, like, actual playthrough of that game, and I was like, we're getting to the Gruntilda fight. This is probably going to be a shorter stream than usual, and it ended up being a couple hours.
Yeah,
I don't think I got every single, like, one of the extra power ups that, like, doubled your health bar and stuff. So it was extra.
Oh yeah, that's actually, that's really helpful.
I forget if I did that too. But yeah, I played pretty far into it, and I really enjoyed it. I don't know why I didn't enjoy it the first time. I guess I was just into other games at the time. But what I like about the game is that it does follow the Mario 64 formula at times, but it's also, like I said, it doesn't take itself seriously. It's funny. The characters are all very cool. I really like them. I like Kazooie the most. She's pretty funny. The graphics are really excellent for the time. And the thing about it is the game is not, except for the Gruntilda fight, which I didn't get into, most of the game isn't that hard. It gives you enough challenge to where it's challenging, but it's not, like, discouraging. It's very easy to get into, and it's very easy to go through the game without having much of a problem. As long as you know what you need to do.
Yeah.
And it's easy to collect enough notes to get to Gruntilda and all the final stage stuff. So I really like that part of the game.
The only issue, generally it wasn't that hard, but yeah, the only time I actually felt like it was a huge, huge undertaking, like, maybe in retrospect it wasn't as hard as I was expecting. As I'm, like, striving it to be, but, Click Clock Wood was definitely kind of a huge step up from the other levels.
Yeah, I was gonna bring that up.
I just remember having some problems with that, yeah.
Because, like, most of the other levels are kind of, like, self-explanatory. You go to this place, and it's just like, oh, you have to go in here and find, you know, the character or find the thing and find your way around. And it's just like, it's not always straightforward, but it's, like, simple enough for you to really... get in and out. Whereas Click Clock Wood, you have to just keep a freaking flow chart of what does what. I mean, at least to me. I mean, I can't speak for people that have been playing this for the past 19 years. Wow, came out 19 years ago. I feel really freaking old now. It was definitely a trip when I got to that level. It was like, oh, okay, this is gonna take some time.
It's because it's a lot more non-linear than the other levels, because you got to go to the different seasons, and like the different something you do in one season will affect the other one, and like stuff like that.
I remember now. It's a bit more trickier than the other stages. So you have to go through all the seasons and stuff and switch.
Yeah, you have to go all through the seasons, and depending on what you do during one season, it changes something in the other season because of just how
that can
changes.
Be kind of a chore.
It can be, but I thought in the end, I thought it was still really cool. It was still really unique.
It's a nice looking level. And, but it is annoyingly difficult because, like, I kept dying or falling off the stupid tree and, like, platforms up there because they're, like, so thin. It's hard to, you know, even when you're going slow, it's really easy to slip off the side of a platform because they're so small. Like, they really should have, made some of those platforms, like, bigger to make it easier to just simply walk around.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like, I guess they made it that way because, it's meant to be challenging and hard, but some of those things you got to jump to and stuff is just insane.
Yeah, that was maybe the only point in the game where it's just, maybe it's time to finish it up. Maybe I should just go for Grunty right now. I don't need to get everything in this world. Like, I wasn't that way with all the other worlds in the first game, where it's like, okay, I think I can 100% everything here, but, like, when I got to Click Clock Wood, after about an hour or two of just trying to platform on some of those skinny-ass platforms, and just not really knowing what to do, I was like, okay, time to take on Grunty. I can leave this for later.
There were some annoying like sections like that in Rusty Bucket Bay as well.
Yeah. I don't remember Rusty Bucket Bay being that as kind
as
of
annoying.
Complex.
I think the main thing is like when you go inside the boat and like the pipes and the engine stuff is sort of annoying. But
I think Rusty Bucket Bay is my favorite track. Like, musically, I think that was the one I was thinking about. I like that one. Yeah, that one. That one's really good.
Then you have levels like Mad Monster Mansion, which is, like, really small and tight, and there's, like, things to do around every corner, pretty much. That one's like, I go back and forth on that one. Sometimes, when I get to that one in the game, I'm like, I don't really want to play this level. And then once you start sort of playing it, you sort of start to enjoy it more, I think. I think it's the theme. I'm not, like, super crazy about the theme, but, like, I end up liking the level overall.
Yeah, Mad Monster Mansion always kind of gave me this, just cheesy theme park haunted house kind of vibe to it, and if you know anything about me, I love cheesy theme park stuff, so that's just right up my alley, just talking flower pots and organ music and spooky ghosts. Ooh. It's just, yeah, I love that stuff. So, Mad Monster Mansion is definitely high up on my list of favorite Banjo-Kazooie worlds.
So, yeah, I'll just like quickly mention how I ended up playing the game originally as well. I think it was suggested to me by someone at school, and a while later, I think I traded in a game or something, and I was looking at like secondhand games. And I was like, okay, I'll give Banjo a go. I started off sort of liking it, and then I got like a little further in, and I was like, oh no, I'm not sure about this. It started to get sort of confusing because I wasn't really that familiar with the like 3D platforming genre, really. Like the progression in Banjo-Kazooie was a bit weird for me sometimes because I think you can't. There is stuff in Banjo-Kazooie you can't get it unless you get a certain move. You've got to come back, right? Or can you do every level straight away? Because I think that threw me a little bit too, like the sort of the non-linear progression of the moves and stuff.
Yeah.
I did end up sort of liking it later on. Like me and a friend started playing through it like one night when he was over and stuff, and we had a pretty good time playing it. I never finished it on the 64 though. I got to, like, probably around Rusty Bucket Bay, Click Clock Woods, and then I sort of just, it got too hard, and I'd stopped playing it on the 64. Probably also because, yeah, the notes reset every time you, die or leave the level. So it was sort of annoying to have to redo everything if you die, and it's easy to die on the later levels.
Yeah, I like I said, I can't even imagine how frustrated kids must have been if they lost a life. I mean, maybe back then kids just had more time to to play those games, so it wasn't really much of a factor. Because
it's also coming off the era, like the past eras, like was closer to like the 16-bit era and the 8-bit era and stuff. So like people like my age were like being what I was like when I played it. I was probably like 11 or 12 or something. But I'd grown up playing like Sonic the Hedgehog and all that sort of stuff, so I was used to sort of biting my head against the wall. Like when you die in Sonic the Hedgehog, you got to start the whole game again. Like when you lose all your lives, so
yeah, I think it was just the fact that there weren't like those kinds of standards of game progression that we take for granted today. Like how it's just saves after every minuscule thing, and doesn't really punish you too much for dying. It's just more of a minor inconvenience, but back then I guess it wasn't really that much of a standard because most people who were playing that game were already used to that on like Nintendo and Super Nintendo.
And for how annoying some of that stuff is, like over like sometimes, but like there is a tension that is lost with games today, because like you just sort of, you're not as tense when you're fighting or doing something, because you're like, oh well, if I die, I'll just be back here in 30 seconds anyway, or less. You might restart right there.
Exactly.
It was tougher back then.
because there was actual consequence for screwing up.
You're on one piece of health and you're like, no, don't die. Like if you're on like 95 notes in Banjo-Kazooie and you got hit by something and you're down to one honeycomb and you just like couldn't find any more honeycombs in the level, the tension was high. Like
And talking about with ukulele, they don't reset any of the quills you collect or the pages or anything, but they do send you back to the very start of the level, which I think is kind of a fairer compromise of, it doesn't really feel like an outright punishment compared to some of the older games of that era, but at the same time, it's still like you kind of take better care of yourself. You learn to start taking better care of your health and your powers and stuff like that, because you don't want to go all the way back because those levels are so big.
I have found the having a similar feeling of tension in some of the ukulele stuff. Like, it's mainly coming from doing some of the challenges and like you getting towards the end and you're like, I don't want to fail. I don't want to do it again. I just want to get it, this part done with. So like you're watching the timer count down. You're like, 15 seconds left. Can I make it? And you're sort of rushing. Mm-hmm. Some of the mini games are a bit like that too. Like you're just like, I just want to beat the stupid high score extra. Just let me do it. But yeah, it sort of brought a bit of that, but without like, when you die, there's no real consequence in ukulele.
Yeah.
What else on Banjo could we bring up?
I don't know. I mean, I think we covered I could talk about different very very specific aspects of Banjo-Kazooie, but over the past 20 years, I mean, a lot of people have pretty much said what there needs to be said. I mean, I never really got to experience like the hype behind like the stop and swap feature.
I sort of missed that as well. But
yeah,
you know what? I was kind of interested in that. So I got far enough in Banjo-Kazooie where wasn't it something where you can put your save data into Banjo-Kazooie 2 or Banjo-Tooie?
Yeah, it was the
basically how it worked. I guess the first models of the Nintendo 64 like retained some memory once you shut it off, or at least if you pulled out a cartridge or something, and they figured out that if you put that memory would retain itself when you put in another cartridge. Like, so their plan was basically at one point in Banjo-Kazooie, you would yank out the cartridge and put in Banjo-Tooie and you would get that extra content if you found those, or maybe it was vice versa. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, they were going to interact both ways, I think.
I think it was both ways. Like you would be able to get the ice key and all those eggs and stuff by yanking out Banjo-Tooie and putting in Banjo-Kazooie. And you would get extra, I think there were like extra modes or items. I wasn't entirely sure.
It's probably maybe like a couple of different areas or a couple of different items or something. But it was never realized because, there was like a 10-second window where you could do the hot swap of the cartridge, but like a revision of the N64 came out and it reduced it down to 1 second. So just, they couldn't do it because not every console could run it.
Yeah. Which was unfortunate. But, I can understand why. I mean, I would imagine that Nintendo probably wasn't really on board with that feature in the first place.
It seems a bit, like, hacky or a bit weird,
and they didn't want to be responsible for like kids damaging their N64 somehow by like trying to yank it out too hard and it just like ends up tumbling off their shelf or breaking or whatever.
You know, thinking about it just then though, I wonder why they didn't consider just using the the controller pack. I wonder if they could have done it that way, like just save some of the data on the controller pack and then.
I think it was just because. It just felt more special by doing it that way.
Yeah.
A lot of those N64 games, I never really had any N64 game that used the memory card. So
a lot of third-party games did it.
Yeah, a lot of third-party games did, but yeah, the game. I can't think of the games I had.
I can't think of a game I used on the memory card. I don't think I even had one.
Yeah, I don't think I ever bought one either. I think maybe I bought. I think I bought some weird like third-party hybrid Rumble Pack and memory card slot. Like the memory card slot went into the memory card went into the Rumble Pack, and he had like a little switch on it. But I never really took advantage of that at all. Like I think maybe Gex was the only game I knew that actually used it, because I remember playing it at this youth center that I went to. It was like, oh yeah, the N64 had memory cards.
I mean, it was so great. You could like hold like one ghost data for Mario Kart on it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I think that's what I ended up using that weird third-party memory card for. It was like, oh, okay, I have something. Here, you can watch me play Wario Stadium poorly.
So, let's move away from Banjo a little bit and just maybe talk about like the genre of the like subgenre of collectathons sort of in general. Like, why do we think, like, what's appealing about them to you guys? Like, why do you think people liked them back in the day, and why, like, did they sort of fade away?
I think it's because with the way worlds are now, they're so deep, and they're deep enough to where you don't really need collectathons. But back in the day, these worlds, compared to today's worlds, 3D worlds, they're not that big. So I think that it was maybe like a compensation in some ways.
Yeah.
And
It encouraged people to just like inspect every single nook and cranny of the world.
It made sure players went through every single thing you need to do in that world. So even though it's not that big, there's still a lot to do, and you have to go through every nook and cranny in order to find a piece or whatever. And there's a ton of stuff to collect in Banjo-Kazooie, and there's a ton of games that followed Banjo-Kazooie that did the same thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were rare games, in fact. So, yeah. I mean, it's not like the worlds were big, but they were contained enough to where you can go around and you can find what you needed to find. And
they weren't big, but they felt big.
Yeah,
and going on to the point of why collectathons aren't really a thing these days. I don't know if it's really just collecting things in games really went away as it more just got pushed to the side. Cause with how much games have advanced in not only technology, but just combat in general. Cause like, you know, when you can have a platformer, or you can have this big action game with guns or swords or whatever. So like there's so many different like game mechanics and combat mechanics that people started taking more advantage of, that, you know, jumping and maybe kicking weren't, like, I guess, as quote-unquote fashionable as, like, toting a gun everywhere or, you know, stuff like that. And I know a lot of games still have a ton of collectibles in them, like even, like, Assassin's Creed and Grand Theft Auto and pretty much any Ubisoft game. There's tons of stuff to collect, but it's not really required. They're more of just like, hey, we gave you this little trinket for, you know, exploring this thing. Even though a lot of games just have this, don't really take into account people that want to explore. Like they have maybe one or two big missions, or maybe a bunch of side quests and stuff where, you know, you have a specific destination where you need to go, and they mark it on your map, and at least to me, when I play missions like that, I'm just looking at that map. I'm not really exploring the world, per se. Like, I just have a waypoint, and I'm being directed towards where I need to go, so I just need to go there, so I'm not, like, stopping to look at everything, because I know there's not really gonna be anything helpful to me. And I think that's the main difference between modern games and games like Banjo-Kazooie and Banjo-Tooie and DK64, where the whole point of those games was to explore and find things to help you along your way.
Yeah.
Whereas just you have pretty much everything you need via side quests or main quests or just everything you need from the get-go. Because you don't really find... There's not really a ton of games where you find weapons or you find new abilities or things. I mean, unless you spend whatever currency or points that you get during the missions at a specific store.
I think it also, like, comes down to, like, why the genre sort of originated as well was, like, yeah, it started with Mario 64, but the reason, or Mario 64, like, the reason Mario 64 sort of had collectibles like the stars and stuff was because they couldn't make a ton of worlds, so they had to reuse the same worlds to fill out the game. And then Banjo-Kazooie and the rest of them sort of just followed suit, like, probably also due to that reason as well. Like, you can have, like, what's 8 or 9 worlds, and if there was, like, one or two things to collect in each one, you'd be done with the game in, like, half an hour.
Yeah.
And, like, they couldn't just keep making worlds because of, you know, memory constraints and all that sort of stuff. So, it sort of, I guess it was born out of that. And then, you know, why do people sort of enjoy just the collecting in general? And I was thinking the other day, like, it's sort of like a weird tangent in a way, but, like, there's, like, people, like, speak about how, you know, people become, like, addicted to, like Twitter and, like, checking notifications and stuff and Facebook and all that sort of thing, right? It's because every time you get, like, a little, like, or an email, if you get, like, an email and you see, like, oh, you got a new email, you got a new tweet or something, you get that little hit of, like, endorphins or whatever it is to, like,
yeah,
to give
I mean,
pleasure.
A lot of it has, yeah.
And I think collecting notes and stuff works the same way in these collectathon games. Like, if you, like, go for the extended period of time without getting notes and stuff, you might start to, like, sort of get tired of it, and you're just like, you just want that next hit of, like, that collecting thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it has to do with the sound design, like, not only with the music, but just the sound and, like, even something like...
Yeah, collecting a lot of notes...
It has to feel good. It has to feel good to collect something.
Yeah.
And it has to feel rewarding, and I feel like stuff, when it comes to, like, Banjo-Kazooie, and... to a lesser extent, Banjo-Tooie, it just felt good to collect something, because you got a little music cue or a dance or, you know, a little, just a nice, just a pleasant, jaunty tune.
Yeah.
And I say that specifically of Banjo-Kazooie, but, like, in Banjo-Tooie, I feel like a lot of that stuff was kind of... There was a few things they kind of abridged, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Collecting notes... I felt was like a little, like the little tune that happened was a little shorter, and you didn't really get like a victory dance after you collected a Jiggy.
Yeah.
And everything just felt like a little snappier, which I understand why they wanted to do that. I understand why they wanted to do that, but at the same time, it just didn't feel as rewarding to me compared to the first game.
I used to like collecting the Jinjos because I liked the little tune that.
And they ran away. I like collecting those too. There needs to be incentive to all these collecting things. And to me, I never like really completed collecting them because there wasn't. I mean, there's stuff you could get, I think, by unlocking all that stuff, but I think there just needs to be sort of an incentive to it, and I never not collected them. I collected them, but I didn't really feel like completing it, if that makes any sense. Like every time I would go out and collect stuff, I would try to, but it wasn't like I would go back and collect every single thing.
See, I would, like, try, like... I don't, like, I'm sort of, like, OCD with the... If I look through the menus and I'm missing, like, one thing on a level or two things, I'm just like, I want that page of totals to look nice and, like, 10 out of 10 complete sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, if I'm, like, maybe one or two away from completing it, I will make sure that I complete it. But if I'm at a point in a level where it's, like, maybe I only have, like, 40-something, and I'm not really feeling... like, exploring this level any further, I'll just move on.
Yeah.
And maybe come back to it later if I feel up to completing it. And, you know, I feel like that's a good thing about Banjo-Kazooie as well, where you didn't have to collect everything. Like, a lot of people like to, you know, dump on these old collect-a-thon games as if you needed to collect every single thing. But you don't really need to. I mean, it just feels really good to do it. And it feels really rewarding to do it. But I don't feel like collecting a lot of things is inherently bad, mm-hmm. per se. It's just a lot of games did it in really bad, annoying ways. But, stuff like Banjo-Kazooie and even like Donkey Kong 64, a lot of people crap on Donkey Kong 64, but, I felt way more satisfied finding every single thing in that game because it felt like I was beating the game at its own game because of how frustrating certain goals were, yeah. and how frustrating certain aspects were. As a kid, being able to just completely overpower the game in spite of the game felt really good to me. And, yeah, a lot of games don't really have that same sense of just reward for just, you know, doing what you need to do to get it, because they just throw out every kind of collectible imaginable, and it doesn't really matter in the long run.
Yeah. I mean, like, again, like DK64, when you sort of start getting into it and you sort of realize the scope of how much stuff there is, you just, like, it is a bit daunting. But then, yeah, once you, if you go for, like, getting everything, just like, hey, yeah, I've got everything, like, mm-hmm. geez,
yeah,
I
mean,
I've come this far. Yeah.
You know, might as well see it out to the end.
And, like, Ukulele is good, like, better than Banjo-Kazooie and stuff in, like, terms of if you get sick of doing something, you can just move on because the requirements to get to the different worlds and stuff is so low. You could unlock all the worlds and then just pick and choose sort of what you want until you get to the...
Yeah, which I actually really appreciate because I was focused on trying to get every single thing in the first world before I started moving on to the next one.
Which you can't do.
Which I soon figured out you can't really do. But I like the feeling that, like, okay, I'm kind of bored with what's going on here because I don't really know what I need to do. But I can go up to the next one and you know, start exploring more. And it's like, oh, wait, I have this power now. I can go back there and do that. Yeah, so it becomes a better incentive to just keep going forward in terms of just discovering new stuff. But at the same time, it's just like, you don't need to do that if you don't want to, but it's it's just a nice feeling. Mm. And
those traits where it's like you don't need to complete an entire world in one sitting. You can just complete enough to where you can move on to the next one. I always really like that in 3D platformers. It doesn't push you to one direction. It allows you to make the choices.
Exactly. And I feel like that's the big thing, the big takeaway when it comes to why these games kind of died off and why maybe a lot, like, why these games aren't really made that much anymore, because I feel like a lot of companies didn't really understand what made it feel good to collect that stuff. And we all talk about Super Mario 64, we all talk about Banjo-Kazooie, and people continue to talk about those games to this day. People don't talk about Tack and the Power of Juju, or Ty the Tasmanian Tiger. No, they talk because those games aren't really that memorable unless that was maybe the only game you had.
Mm.
But it's like people still talk about Banjo-Kazooie and Super Mario 64 and Donkey Kong 64 and even stuff like Sly Cooper and Jak and Daxter on PS2 is because they knew what they were doing. They knew collecting things had to feel good. They had to feel rewarding, and they had to have some incentive to actually, you know, continue to go. And I feel like a lot of companies just kind of were seeing what Banjo-Kazooie and Jak and Daxter and Mario 64 were doing, but they didn't really... They thought the collecting thing and jumping was enough.
Yeah,
they didn't really take
into what they were doing with sales, and then they went in a direction where, oh, what if I make this goofy animal into a platforming star, I will sell lots of copies.
Yeah, we'll sell lots of copies, but in the end, it doesn't work like that, though. Yeah, it doesn't work like that at all. And I feel like that's why the genre died, is because there were so many of those games that just felt pointless, considering you had all these games that were just defying the platformer genre. Like, because there was so much more technology, so many more engines to work with, so many more genres that you can, you know, tackle, like, really, really well, like, you know, they were just basically combining what was great about those games with whatever game they had, like, whether it's a shooter or an action-adventure game, like God of War or something like that, where it's just, you have those collectibles, but it's like, that was just kind of a side thing.
Yeah.
Because it took a backseat to, you know, the combat. And the combat was basically, I feel like, is probably the most important factor in this, too. Because why would anybody want to make a game where all you do is just run or jump or roll, when you can have these badass swords and guns and stuff like that, and all these different mechanics and combos you can do, and have these just theatrical, cinematic, finishing moves, and just, not even finishing moves, but just regular moves as well. It just felt, people, I guess the market was more kind of gearing towards things being more complex when it came to, you know, how you play games like that, and people didn't really appreciate the simplicity of, because they saw those platformer games, like, oh, that's just too simple and dumb. And, you know, even publishers and developers were kind of shying away from stuff like that. And, like, even Rareware, like, if you hear them talk about, you know, why Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts happened, was because they misread the market. They didn't think anybody wanted just a simple platformer. They wanted something more with more complexity, and, you know, what's more complex than cars, really?
Yeah. I just feel with Nuts and Bolts, they completely misread what people wanted with a third Banjo-Kazooie game.
Mm. On the surface, I mean, like, I don't like Nuts and Bolts that much, but I can see that it's a quality game. On the surface, it feels like it's nothing really connected to Banjo-Kazooie, but in a weird way, it has some of the... You're still, like, going after characters and doing a challenge, and you're still sort of exploring the world. You're doing a lot of the same things. It's just, you're not doing it as
running and jumping. You're not doing it in a way that people wanted
you to. Yeah, I mean, like, the car, driving around the car now isn't as much fun as, like, doing all the moves that
Banjo-Kazooie. The thing is, I could forget all that if it was actually, like, a fun game, but it's not.
I always wanted to give that game a try, just out of curiosity's sake, because, you know, it is still starring Banjo-Kazooie and Gruntilda and all those characters, but, like, I still love that the world that those games take place in and all those characters. Yeah. So it'd be nice to try that one of these days, because I still don't have an Xbox One, but I do have a copy of Rare Replay, because I just ordered that in the hopes that I would get an Xbox One sometime soon.
Yeah, I'm gonna buy Rare Replay as well. And, like, get an Xbox One. But...
I have Rare Replay, but I completely forgot the Nuts and Bolts was on there. So now I kind of feel like I have to, like, play it again.
I'll
give it a shot. I mean, I feel like there are people that praise it. I mean, they're odd, but odd as that may be, like, you know, even, like, the Giant Bomb people, they actually love Nuts and Bolts compared to, like, the first two Banjo-Kazooie games, which I think is insane, but, you know, hey, that's their prerogative. I actually think it does look neat in the same way that, I don't know if you guys ever played this game on the old Windows PCs, I think it was called Gadgets and Gizmos.
No.
It was by a company called The Learning Company. They made these, like, Super Solvers games. They were, like, these kind of semi-educational games where it teaches you, like, reading comprehension or math. And there was one in particular called Gadgets and Gizmos where it taught you about physics. And basically you had to beat this, insane professor guy, in these series of races, and you had to, like, go around and solve these physics problems and build these cars and different kinds of air vehicles and stuff like that. It was all like physics based. Like, you know, you had to figure out like aerodynamics and how they would fly and different things like that. And when I saw Nuts and Bolts for the first time, when I thought it was like, oh, so it's like kind of a next gen version of Gadgets and Gizmos. That's an interesting take. You know, everybody's favorite Windows game.
I mean, like, yeah, Nuts and Bolts isn't a bad game. It's just, yeah, like, it sort of missed the mark for, like, Banjo fans that were, at the time, like, really holding out for Banjo 3E. Like, I think that's what sort of killed it as well. Like, if Banjo 3E had come out in, like, 2005, and then Nuts and Bolts came out in 2007, I think it would have been received much better.
Yeah. Because I think it's just, a lot of Rare fans were just in denial of Rare still being good as a developer, because they made some questionable games. They were all like kind of varying in quality. I mean, I thought Viva Pinata was really good, but like stuff like Grabbed by the Ghoulies and what was that launch title? Perfect Dark Zero.
Yeah,
I felt like disappointed a lot of people.
I think it's when they went into the Kinect stuff and they started just being a Kinect developer. I think that's when people were like, I think Rare's seen its best days behind it.
And it sort of feels like, it felt like with Rare Replay coming out that like, okay, they're sort of like pushing the reset button on Rare. They're going to launch this game and then they're going to come out swinging with like a bunch of like games again and like be sort of try and build themselves up as like a powerhouse developer again. But
yeah,
since then, they're nothing. They're still working on Sea of Thieves. I mean,
yeah, and I hope Sea of Thieves is great, because I think that concept is great.
Yeah,
and I hope they really pull it off, because they really did kind of piss off a lot of their fans. Like, I don't know if you guys remember, but there was a website, I think it was called it might have been Mundo Rare. It was a fan website. I think it was like a Spanish fan website that they wanted to do a documentary on Rareware, during their Kinect years, and they wanted to talk about all their past stuff. But Rareware denied their request to do the documentary because it wasn't quote on message.
Yes, that's
enough. Yeah. Because I guess for whatever reason they wanted their image to be, you know, they wanted to be like the Wii crowd. They wanted to be like a Wii kind of developer. It's like, oh, we're family friendly, sports, getting up and having fun. We don't talk about those crude bears and squirrels anymore. No. Those were all wild college days. No, we're grown up now. We have kids.
But anyway, so anything else you guys want to add about sort of Banjo or the genre in general? I think we've sort of covered a lot of it there.
Mm-hmm. I'm just really hoping stuff like Yooka-Laylee and the upcoming Hat in Time definitely makes people realize what made this genre so special.
I mean, hey, like Mario Odyssey is coming into the year. That's probably gonna, you know, show everyone what a modern day 3D platformer like, you know, mm-hmm. Mario 64 is going to be like now.
I don't think platformers never really died. They were just kind of pushed to the side. Like, people forget how good a really good platformer could be.
Actually, that's what I was going to say. Like, in the early 2000s, around the time of, like, Mario Sunshine and stuff, like, a lot of people, including myself, were like, okay, I'm kind of getting tired of these platforming games that aren't very tight, don't feature tight platforming, like hard, challenging, just pure platforming, as much, like, you know, they had platforming, but like it was spaced out a lot more than say, like, you know, Mario Galaxy stuff, which like Nintendo, you know, started going towards for the last, since Mario Galaxy. So it's been about 10 years mm-hmm. of sort of Nintendo going, okay, let's bring back the, like, just pure platformer with no frills sort of, like, stuff to it. And now they're going to go sort of back the other direction and explore the more laid-back sort of exploratory nature of 3D platformers, which I feel like, yeah, now I'm sort of getting tired of the tight platforming and sort of like, okay, and you know, I wouldn't mind having something a bit more open and a bit more relaxed now.
Yeah, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, so, like, I don't know if you remember back in the GameCube days where, you know, there were a lot of kind of experimental, like, Nintendo was very experimental with their main games. Like, they weren't really playing to what, like, the quote-unquote, what the fans wanted.
Yeah.
Like, everything was just, oh, this is gimmicky, stupid jetpack, I don't like the double carts and the stupid cel-shaded Zelda and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that kind of scared Nintendo a little bit, because they couldn't because I don't think they really wanted to, like, take those kinds of risks with their genres anymore, because, you know, the GameCube didn't really do that well, and, you know, it was a struggle to get a copy of a game selling a million copies.
Mm.
And so, yeah, so they just went back to basics for a while. They just had these no-frills, just tight controlling platformers, because that's what people were clamoring for the longest time, and now
people New Super Mario Brothers, that's exactly what it is, right?
Exactly, yeah. Like, especially New Super Mario Brothers, because people were clamoring for a new Super Mario Brothers game. Like, yeah. They wanted a new side-scroller game, because the only Mario games they were putting out on the GBA were either the RPGs or, yeah, you know, remakes of the NES and Super Nintendo games.
I mean, by the time New Super Mario Bros. On DS came out, it had been 10 years since Yoshi's Island, so...
Mm-hmm.
Like...
And, yeah, and I feel like people ended up getting tired of those games.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't very new, and then they released, like, 3 sequels, and they weren't very new either.
Yeah. And, yeah, so I think this is probably the right... It is the right time for them to kind of take that more exploratory kind of jump with their franchise.
I think they've taken the tight sort of platforming, like, structure, like, as far as they can possibly take it. If they just made another one of those, it would be very similar to 3D World or Galaxy. Mm. Like, it's not really much more headroom, I think, there for them to explore at the moment. But, like... Going back the other way, there's a lot of they can sort of think about design-wise, and, like, you know, there's a lot more room for improvement or different ideas in the opposite way, which they're obviously doing with Mario Odyssey.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at their YouTube channel, the Mario Odyssey trailer is their most viewed game trailer, like, in their entire channel's history. So I think, yeah, they picked the exact right time to go back to that style.
Because
they knew that's what people really wanted. So, we'll see how that plays out. And, you know, I hope stuff like, you know, Mario Odyssey, Yooka-Laylee, and, you know, other games just kind of follow suit and just kind of just give people what they want, is just to explore a fun world. Like I said, I'm just hoping that it pays off in the end.
Yeah, I really hope that, like, Yooka-Laylee sells okay for Playtonic, because I really don't want them to, like, struggle to survive after one game.
Yeah, me too.
I really want to see them, you know, go forward and make improvements and sort of find their feet again.
Yeah, the one thing I'm kind of worried about with Yooka-Laylee is the dumb controversy that's surrounding it. I'm not going to go into details, because everybody knows, and it's already been talked to death. But I will say that Yooka-Laylee deserves way, way more credit than people are trying to make of it. Like, people are trying to paint this as a Mighty Number 9.
Level
disaster.
I absolutely do not get that. Like, if you listen to this and you're like thinking, I'm not going to buy Yooka-Laylee because it's a dumpster fire, just don't listen to that sort of thing. Like,
it's at least average.
Like,
for whatever reason, people just want a controversy. They want something to fail because they got such a thrill out of the Ooyah and Mighty No. 9 and stuff like that, of how much failure there was with that. And they want to paint that same kind of... They want there to be that kind of controversy with something like this, too, because of that stupid friggin' reason. And they want to just, like, hammer down, like, oh, see, that person said that, so that means it sucks. And it's just like, I hope it doesn't hurt Playtonic in the long run, because they made, in all honesty, they made a good game.
Yeah.
They delivered on what they promised.
I mean, I have some niggles here and there, but like, I would say it's a solid game. Like, it's
exactly
nothing overly wrong with it. I mean, there's room for improvement, but it's exactly what they promised. And
yeah, they set out to make an N64 style platformer, and guess what? They made an N64 style platformer, for better or for worse.
Yeah, the whole point was to basically make Banjo-3. I mean, that was pretty much their stated goal. I mean, if they strayed too far from, you know, trying to reinvent the wheel, people probably would have called them out on it then, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the sad thing is, with all the controversy, it's just, you know, outrage culture is kind of in, and that could be for both sides of the spectrum. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it's going to happen. It's this kind of day and age where that's the norm, and it sucks, but from what I've seen, I can't get the thing that, you know, this is like too much borrowing from Banjo-Kazooie, and I kind of get that. I understand why it's, but, you know, that's what people backed on Kickstarter. They wanted a sequel, spiritual sequel, I guess you can call it.
Mm-hmm.
A spiritual sequel to Banjo-Kazooie, and this
and they weren't, and they weren't shying away from that either. They knew exactly what they were making. They knew exactly, people knew exactly what they were donating towards, and they knew exactly what they were getting. And to see all these people just surprised at, you know, the fact that it's what it is just silly.
Yeah.
And you know what I say to what I want to say to all this controversy, all this negativity? Yeah.
Yep. I agree.
And I think on that note, we'll wrap up the episode. So thanks, guys, for joining me on this discussion. It was pretty fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me. I know I haven't really been, like, you know, I kind of resigned from NWR, like, about a year ago at this point. But I still would love to continue to keep in touch with you guys. And, you know, if you ever want me on for another segment, I'd definitely be glad to. I kind of forgot how fun this was.
yeah, definitely. I'll have you on again, Kurt. So
awesome.
Yep.
Alrighty, thanks everyone for listening, and if you'd like to send us an email, you can do so at connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com, or we are on Twitter, which is @connectivitynwr. So with that, we'll say goodbye, and yeah, thanks for listening. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Start, bloop, 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 exit game. We'll be right back.
Thank you.